Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you're enjoying your lunch. Please continue, but we'll be starting shortly. Before that, just a few housekeeping matters. Of course, if you'd be so kind as to turn your phones off so that we can have a good talk and a question and answer session afterwards. The Chief Minister Lim is very keen to take your questions and to interact, and he's promised to keep his comments concise and powerful in order to leave as much time as possible for interaction with the audience. I'll also mention that we have another club lunch coming up on the 8th, which is The Hidden Story of the Great Famine in China Under Mao by Dr. Zhou Shun, which should be a very good talk if any of you have time to come for that. Once again, my name is Douglas Wong. I'm the president of the Foreign Correspondents Club. The election for president of the Foreign Correspondents Club is not half as challenging as elections in Malaysia. And we're very grateful today to have Mr. Lim Guan Eng here again. He spoke just over a year ago here, telling us about how he had taken office in Penang after many years as an opposition politician, and all the things that he'd done and hoped to do for Penang. I think we're all very interested today to hear more about what his analysis and prognosis of for Malaysia is in the year ahead, especially as we are going to have elections there in the next 6 months. And as I think Mr. Lim will tell us, some people see that Malaysia may be at a tipping point. As a Malaysian, I've only known one government. I think most Malaysians have only known one government. Is there going to be a change? Should we be concerned? How much risk is there? We're very, very honored and grateful to have here today to talk to us about that, Mr. Lim Guan Eng.
Thank you, Douglas. I'd like to thank the Foreign Correspondents Club for inviting me back again. Now, usually when you come back a second time, normally is that you haven't done a good job the first time round. You try to pick up the second time round. So I'm very honored to be able to be speaking in front of such a distinguished audience, comprising not only of Malaysians, but those who are concerned about what is happening in Malaysia. Now, the topic of my discussion today is Malaysia's tipping point. Now, if you look at the term tipping point, it is, of course, in Malcolm Gladwell's seminal work in 2000, where he described the moment where change becomes a reality as a tipping point. And he defined it as the moment of critical mass, the threshold of the boiling point. Gladwell described three agents of change: the law of the field, or Pareto principle of 80-20, where 80% of the work is done by 20% of the participants, resulting in the success of change being dependent on the involvement of people with a particular set of social gifts. Number two, the stickiness factor to ensure effective retention of content and impact. And finally, the power of context, where human behavior is sensitive to and strongly influenced by its environment. Now, I submit that all three agents of change, as mentioned or described by Malcolm Gladwell, are present in Malaysia, which puts Malaysia at a tipping point for a possible regime change in the next general elections. Four important factors constitute the tipping point for progressive change, while one factor may cause Malaysia to tip back to regressive change. The first factor is that Malaysians are repugnant of entrenched and widespread corruption and believe that only a change of government can put an end to corruption. Malaysians are convinced that whatever the mistakes made by the four Pakatan Rakyat state governments in Malaysia, Pakatan Rakyat has generally performed better because we are clean, and there is implicit trust in the integrity of leadership as exemplified by open competitive tenders, Freedom of Information Act, as well as full disclosure of government contracts with the private sector, and public declaration of assets by leaders certified by international accounting firms. The second factor is that Malaysians are hungry for change. Hungry for change from an inept, oppressive and abusive regime to a competent, democratic one that protects basic human freedoms. In the past, change was not possible as there was no multiracial alternative to Parisa National. Now we have a credible alternative comprising Malaysians from all hues and backgrounds, owned by nearly 5 years of experience in government, that is competent and honest, led by a nationally accepted leader in Anwar Ibrahim. Three, the political weapons of fear, threats and lies would no longer be as effective as in the past. Fear of racial unrest, such as the 1969 May 13 racial riots, has receded as a change of government can only happen when Malays desire change. As we have to accept the political reality that Malays constitute a majority of the voters. If Parisa National loses and there's a change of government, it can only happen if the Malays want change. So the reality is that it will not be Malays against non-Malays, but it will be Malays against those who do not want change. The birthday rallies 1.0, 2.0, 3.0 have shown that Malaysians of all races can work together for justice and clean elections. Malaysians can also make informed decisions by no longer relying on media outlets monopolized by the government through access to the internet. This is a technological, political, economic and social revolution whose impact is global. The yearning for change is only amplified by the change happening instantaneously in many parts of the world. The fourth factor is the question of East Malaysia and the rural vote. East Malaysia and the Rural Vote Bank has always been seen as a safe deposit for Parisa National. That safe deposit is no longer safe. The defections of four Parisa National representatives from Sabah, the loss of the Cebu parliamentary seat in the by-election in Sarawak, coupled with huge crowds and Pakatan Raya rallies, shows that the political tsunami that swept Peninsular Malaysia may finally be coming to East Malaysia. And as you know, Sabah and Sarawak contributes 57 of the 222 parliamentary seats, which is 26%. In the last general elections, Pakatan Rakyat only won 2 out of 57 seats. And this is a handicap that we cannot afford to leave, because failing which, Parisa National would retain power. So if we do not break this so-called safe deposit, we will find it difficult for us to win. And as I said just now, the safe deposit is no longer safe. Even the rural vote bank, which is seen as a bastion for Parisa National, there is also disquiet in the rural vote bank, exacerbated by the fall in commodity prices. As the Prime Minister Dato' Sri Najib continues to dilly-dally over calling for elections, such delays only work against him, as there's no prospect of a strong recovery over the next few months. The two principal commodities, oil palm and rubber. Oil palm prices have dropped by 32% this year alone, from 3,215 ringgit per tonne to 2,183 ringgit per tonne as at 8th of October 2012. A fall in price of 1,032 ringgit per tonne, or 32%. And of course, this is a far cry from the high of 3,930 ringgit per tonne in 2008. As for rubber, it has dropped by 41 cents, or 6% this year, to 630 cents a kilogram, compared to 671 cents per kilogram at the beginning of the year. Again, a far cry from the highest point of 1,045 cents in April 2011. Even the listing of the much ballyhooed Felda Global Ventures Holdings were hot, said to be the second largest IPO in the world this year, has lost its luster. The initial excitement of the listing has obviously died down. Its shares went down to 4 ringgit 57 cents in September 11, very close to its listing price of 4 ringgit 55. Yes, since gone back up to 4 ringgit 75 cents today. But of course, that is still a very lethargic performance. According to the Star report, Felda's Global Ventures Holdings profits fell 87% to 192 million in the first quarter of 2012. This will definitely have an impact on Felda settlers who are presumed to be hardcore Barisan National and UMNO supporters. However, having mentioned the four positive tipping points in favour of Sheikh, there is another tipping point in favour of Barisan National that may just tip the balance back in their favour. And that fifth negative tipping point, if I can describe it, is electoral fraud. The Elections Commission in Malaysia has shown itself to be far from impartial, far from free, far from fair, and of course, far from clean. Instead, the Elections Commission has an abysmal record of being a ready tool of the ruling party, where its top members are even members of UMNO. If BN succeeds in planting in the phantom voters, Barisan Nasional can yet cheat its way to victory. In conclusion, the final electoral results will ultimately depend on Najib, the Prime Minister. Whether the Prime Minister wants to be a real reformer or merely a performer, where he is long on rhetoric but short on action. All his so-called reforms are cosmetic until Malaysians feel shortchanged. Malaysians seek a new dawn, where there's a burst of freedom, justice, democracy and integrity in leadership. If the Prime Minister still allows charges of accumulation of extraordinary wealth by the Sarawak Chief Minister or the record-breaking wedding of the Malacca Chief Minister with 130,000 guests for his son's wedding to go uncontested, then Malaysia has indeed reached the tipping point. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lim, and you kept it concise and sharp, and you're going to stay there at the podium to take, we have a good 25 minutes for questions and answers, so I know my fellow Malaysians, you have a lot of opinions, and you're very sharp, and all our FCC members here have the same qualities. So if I could ask anyone who has a question for the Chief Minister to indicate, someone will come to you with a microphone, and then if you could just identify yourself and we'll take your question. So I saw the gentleman in the back there.
So Chief Minister, $64,000 question. When is the election?
I think the $64,000 question can only be answered by the Prime Minister. But the window is getting smaller and smaller. So the only prospect is next year or next month. So if there is an election this year, yes, call it very quickly. And if not, then it will be after the Chinese New Year. Thank you.
Minister, firstly, as a Penangite, I have to confess and admit to a self-interest. I think you did a fantastic job in Penang. From a micro issue, Are we going to get Penang port sorted out? Is it going to get dredged? What's the potential for the future, and do you have to rely on the federal government to do it?
Thank you. Well, thank you for that.
And the airport as well, while we're at it, sorry.
Well, thank you for that endorsement for Penang. And we'll definitely try to fulfill your expectations and make it even better. Provided, of course, that we retain Penang at the next elections. Talking about the airport and, of course, the port, we finally managed to get the federal government to expand the airport. Of course, the progress leaves much to be desired, but at least they're doing something about it. And the port is something that is a little bit more difficult because it is a well, it's called a privatization exercise. They claim that they conducted an open tender, but this is an open tender by invitation. So it's not an open competitive tender. It's actually a closed tender. And naturally, the cronies got it. So here, we do not see how it can benefit Penang and it can improve efficiency. But we are still awaiting for discussions with the relevant authorities. Because whether the federal government likes it or not, they still have to get state approval since some of the parts of the port sits on government land, state government land. So I think that is something that is still to be sorted out. In terms of dredging, you have to dredge the channel. And that costs a tremendous sum, 353 million ringgit over 5 years. Which means that you have to spend $1 billion over 15 years. Would not it be better to build probably a new port somewhere in Penang? Or perhaps look at other possibilities where you can have a natural port without doing the necessary dredging. But if the government doesn't do dredging, the port is not vital. And by procrastinating over dredging, it is only doing the port more harm than good. Thank you very much.
This is a humorous and a scandalous question. I heard on the grapevine in Hong Kong, because we are away from home, that the Malaysian government will be asked to attend the French court just before the election over the purchase of the submarines from France that wouldn't sink properly, and hence was spotted by the government of Brunei, who was very paranoid whether the Malaysian government was going to take their oil fields away, and so had engineered for Mr. Baginda, is it Mr. Baginda, who was charged with the murder of Atan Tula, the model, to attend court in France. So that I understand the timing will be quite crucial to the outcome of the Malaysian election. Can you confirm this scandalous thing to be true or not?
Well, I can only confirm that Atatunya was murdered by C4 explosives. I can only confirm that it was related to the Scorpion submarine scandal. I can only confirm that when they bought the submarine, they didn't test drive it, which is why they didn't know it couldn't dive initially. As for the other questions that you raised, I think we will only know the truth when there's a change of government. Thank you.
Chief Minister, post-independence, the Malaysian political landscape has been really dominated along racial lines. And this continues to be the case, whether we like it or not, is a fact. And the AP's partner in opposition is PAS, among others. And this is a major conflict for more liberal-minded voters to have to think through and accept that one of the major components of your coalition is in fact a fundamentalist, for a better word. How do you go about dealing with this challenge to convince voters that the past agenda in particular going forward will not be a major issue for you to, if you were to come to government?
Thank you very much for posing that question, because at least it gives me the opportunity to explain and probably push the elephant off the room. The question of reconciling the differences, I would say it's not as difficult as reconciling the differences within BN. On the one side, you have UMNO, which is a supremacist Malay party, and we have MCA, which is a supremacist Chinese party, and we have a MIC, which is a supremacist Indian party. Races working together against the interests of the respective race. It doesn't make sense. But when you talk about DAP and PAS, even though DAP stands strongly for the federal constitution, and PAS aspires for an Islamic state, there is respect for each other's views. We agree to disagree. And there's a recognition that whilst in any democratic society, each party is allowed to, of course, take their own respective positions. But it does not mean that we cannot cooperate on common issues, on common ground, fighting corruption, freedom, justice, democracy. Now, PAS is as committed to democracy as all the parties in Pakatan are. They have never resorted to violence. When they lose, they pick themselves up and we work and fight again in the next elections. And whether Barisan Nasional admits to it or not, PAS leaders are clean, just like the DAP. So I think in that respect, we do not see any difficulty in cooperating to oppose a corrupt, abusive, and oppressive regime. Their leaders have been detained under the ISA, just as we are detained under the ISA. And in order to ensure that when we cooperate with our eyes open, we have agreed to a common framework where there's no mention of Islamic State, there's no mention of Hudud Law, and we have put pen to paper. All three have signed to that document. In a future PR government, we uphold the federal constitution. No Islamic State, no Hudud Laws. Thank you very much.
Minister Lim, I'm Toh Han Chi, a reporter from the South China Morning Post. Do you have any comments on, you know, the massive growing number of Chinese communist state companies building all this infrastructure in Malaysia, like the bridge in Penang and maybe the port in Penang, and the tourist resorts in Johor and the railway in Malaysia? I mean, what do you think of them in the context of UMNO money politics? And given that these are mainland communist Chinese, how do you see the interesting dynamics between them and the ruling UMNO party and the Malays, compared to the old historical tensions between Malaysian Chinese and Malaysian Malays?
I wouldn't be able to answer that question. I wouldn't have the figures and statistics. I can only speak for Penang. They are building the second bridge. They are building our dam, a new dam, which costs around ₱1 billion. But I don't think they are doing our ports as yet. As for the other contracts, as I said, I am not posted in terms of how extensive they have won construction contracts in Malaysia. But it only goes to show the cynicism and the skepticism that Malaysians look at Barisan Nasional. As I mentioned just now, you have a Malay supremacist party working with Chinese mainland companies, and they should be antidote, isn't it? So in that sense, it's all about business. It's all about breaking it in. It's all about getting on the gravy train. And what we see here that we are concerned about is whether there is genuine privatization, whether there is open competitive tenders. And unfortunately, despite talk to the contrary by the federal government, there is no open competitive tenders in Malaysia, except for PR governments. And that is why many Malaysians feel that the privatization in Malaysia is a sham. It's not privatization, it is privatization. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Fred Chan. A few of us, very fortunate that the Hong Kong Museum Society came for a few-day trip to visit your great city. We have a wonderful time. We were being shown all the great sites and culture and arts and enjoy all the good food and fine sight. And we have VIP treatment from the Chief Minister, and we have visit the office and all that, and have dinner. And we were really impressed. We all knew that you've gone through very difficult hardship as a politician to get to where you are, including a jail term. And you work so hard, you are 24/7 working hard for the benefit of the city. And wish we in Hong Kong have someone, including all of us, learning from you. And when you have time, I'm doing a little bit of promotion for the city, and please take the next vacation and go to Penang. And now there are two direct flights from Cathay Pacific. It's very short. And I'm sure our Chief Minister would take care, very good care of you. But my question is really that after we learn about the great life that you people have in Malaysia, and you have great difficulty, you have to live with the majority, you have a lot of conflict between the different people, and you overcome all that. And the people there become very civic minded. I was really impressed to look at the cultural heritage and all the preservation and all the community mind of the business people. And so everybody was enjoying the good life at Georgetown, the nightclub, at the jazz bar at night with your co-workers. And I just want, if you want us to invest more money in your town, which is not something we worry about, can you pack with us some word of wisdom on how we Hong Kong politicians and businessmen professional can learn from you and try to work together to build a better life for us so that we make a little bit more money and we can all come to Penang and buy a home and a vacation and invest. So I appreciate if you stay longer, we'll make it work for Hong Kong. But I know that you have to go back and do your work. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think Penang has a lot to learn from Hong Kong. Of course, many from Hong Kong probably doesn't feel that way. In the sense that we feel that things work in Hong Kong. Perhaps it's a question of now that you are still trying to exercise, as I said, able to live with dignity, with full freedoms. I think that's what probably Hong Kongers are looking at. Since that you've really attained a reasonable standard of living. But I think as far as Penang is concerned, we were rather on the back waters for the previous 20 years. So we are trying to get back on track. And I think the successes we have achieved so far is a testimony to the hard work put in by Penangites. No, we've got so many talented Penangites. Many of them were in Hong Kong. And of course, those I claim to be Penangite, you know, whether you're from Kedah or you're from the north of Perak, I consider you as Penangite because you're part of that Penang diaspora, so to say. And it is because of your talents that Penang has succeeded. So what we lost out was, I think what Hong Kong realized long ago, that it is human talent that determines the success of any economy. And if we lose sight of that lesson, and I mean if Hong Kong forgets that basic, of course, then I think the only way you will go is downhill, not uphill. So in that respect, again, as I said, we've got still many things to do. We've got still much to learn, but we are focused on transforming Penang to be an international and intelligent city. One that is clean, one that is green, one that is safe, and one that is healthy. And I believe that many people or many of our friends from Hong Kong feels that Penang reminds them of days of nostalgia in Hong Kong. And we will, of course, not have as many skyscrapers as you have in Hong Kong, but definitely we ensure that the people in Penang will be able to live with dignity, will to live with respect, and I think most importantly that they have a stake in the decision making in their lives. But what we are, of course, again talking about today, is that we cannot live in a vacuum. We cannot live in an island, which Penang is. We are part of this national fabric called Malaysia. And if we want to move forward, the whole country has to move forward. And that's why when we talk about change, in that respect, we are very hopeful for change, not only from Malaysians outside of Penang or the Penang diaspora, but also for the local Malaysians here. I was talking to Douglas just now, and he mentioned that there appears to be a commitment, an energized commitment amongst many Malaysian residents here to return home when elections are called, because we all want to be part of that change, which was never possible for the last 55 years. Douglas said that he had only known one government. You know, when you had only one wife, that's okay. But when you have only had one government, I think that is somehow not right. Because when you talk about democracy, it's about choice, it's about alternatives. Especially when the present one has shown itself to be not up to the job. So I would again probably take this opportunity to ask all Malaysians, wherever you are, to come back, to be part of that change, to help us to make this change a reality. And do not say that it cannot be done. It can be. Thank you.
You inspired a lot more hands to go up, Mr. Lim, and I think we've got about 10 minutes left, if that's all right. So I'll take as many questions as I can in that time. Firstly, the lady over there.
In the next election, you need 112 seats to form the government. And I just did a back of envelope calculation. If you retain your current 82, and assuming you take over MCA's 15, that leaves you with another 15 in order to form the government. How do you assess the probability that you'll be able to capture 15 more seats? That's question number one. And number two is that if assuming you do get 112, how ready is Pakatan to form the government?
Thank you. I think as I mentioned in my earlier speech, tipping point. One of the tipping points is BN safe deposit vote banks in the rural areas and in East Malaysia. In East Malaysia with 57 seats, they won 55 last round. So if we are able to make a breakthrough by winning at least one third, I think we are already right there at the door. And of course, the rural vote bank will also be very crucial. As I mentioned, with the drop in commodity prices, it has created a sense of disquiet. And all this, I think, is coming together. I do not understand why the Prime Minister didn't call for the elections earlier. If I were him, I would have done it earlier. Because somehow the stars in East Malaysia are not really aligned in his favor at the moment. So it is possible. You look at the makeup, there are 165 seats in the peninsula. We won 80 out of 165, which means Barisan Nasional won 85, a lead of only 5 seats. They won because they won big in East Malaysia. And the events unfolding over the last few months have shown that we have penetrated and we have made significant breakthroughs in East Malaysia. Number two, if we win, how confident are we of being able to run and take over the administration? I think this is where we got to look back at our record. When we took over Penang, for instance, we never expected to be the government. But when the time came, I think we seized the opportunity with both hands. We worked hard, And I think most important of all, we trusted in our people. Finally, I think it's a question whether the government dares to put its faith in its people. Because somehow, the people being resourceful will find a solution for the government. So I think it is time that we go back to people, place your faith and trust in them. I think then we will have people-centric solutions to the people's problems. Thank you.
Maybe just one or two more questions. Take one of the gentlemen, if you could agree, at the front here, which of you two would take question?
Aaron again.
Sure.
Is Omar a threat to unknown?
Anwar is a threat to unknown? Yes, definitely. he's the biggest threat since Merdeka. Thank you.
Now, Mr. Lim's just indicated that he's willing to run over time a little. I am conscious that some of you may have other appointments to go to rush to after this lunch, but we'll just see how we go in terms of questions. The gentleman there.
Yes, of course, of course. I think I mentioned the Rural Vote Bank. The Rural Vote Bank is basically Malay. You talk about East Malaysia, it's also basically the native population. But as I mentioned in my other tipping point, is that if you talk about change, about regime change, it can only happen if the Malays and the native population, which is basically the Imans and Karazans, desire change. If they don't desire change, even if the non-Malays vote 100% for the opposition, there will be no change. And even we will not be able to win Penang without at least getting a substantial minority of the Malay votes. And we got the substantial minority of the Malay votes in the last elections. So you need the support from all demographic groups, whether you like it or not. That's the reality. So in that sense, if there is a change of government, you must have the support from all demographics. It will be a Malaysian government. Thank you.
As eight, the generation coming up, has that changed the electorate at all?
Yes, definitely. And I think the younger generation will tend to be more pro-change, like in every part of the world. So that's why you're asking for the voting age to be reduced from 21 to 18. And they've resisted that. Because they know if they do that, then they will lose more seats. Thank you.
Minister, given the possibility that if the opposition wins and it's quite likely that what do you think is the potential of the army stepping in? I mean, Malaysia does not have a tradition of coups, but that is a possibility.
Well, that is a question of whether you think the army and the police would shoot demonstrators who want change. I think that would be the question. Finally, what that would be the question. It goes back to what I mentioned just now about May 13th. The federal government is using the weapon of fear to frighten the people to vote for Barisan Nasional. That if there is change, you see a repeat of the racial riots in 1969. Malay against non-Malay. Now, would that happen? As I said just now, the political reality in Malaysia is because of the number of voters, majority being Malay. Change can only come if Malays desire change. Which means that if there is change and you do not allow change to happen, who will go to the streets to demand that the mandate of the people will be respected? It will be the Malays. In that sense, Malays who want change against those who do not want. in that type of scenario, would you think that the army and the police would shoot at the demonstrators? I would say not. Because no army and police in the world would shoot at their own demo, at their own people. And you're talking about police and army, majority of our Malays, shooting at their own people, Malays. Yes, we have seen had that happening in the Middle East. We have seen that happening in many other countries. If it cannot happen in Egypt, if it cannot happen in the Middle East, I don't think it will happen in a country which has regular elections like in Malaysia. Anyone who tried that, I think they would suffer a much worse fate than losing in the elections. Thank you.
Mr. Lim, you tackled a lot of elephants today. I see a number of very keen people today questions. With the indulgence of the room and of yourself, shall we take just two more? Three more? Does that work for everyone? Okay, so the gentleman there with the tie, the lady there, and the gentleman.
Hi, Abhik Balachani, I'm with the Wall Street Journal. You talked about Najib not as a reformer, but as a performer, and I'm wondering what you make of the number of relaxations of security laws, etc., that he's enacted in the last 1 year. I mean, I realize the opposition says that the replacement is also problematic, but the replacement is probably not as problematic as the original laws. So in the sum of things, I wonder how much credit you'd give Najib for at least trying these things, or why you think he's trying them, if you don't think he's being a genuine reformer.
Well, I said that he's a performer rather than a reformer, because you still get people being charged for sedition. Sedition is outlawed, but yet you still get people being threatened to be charged for sedition. Shouldn't that be in the archives of history? But it's not. You look at the right of peaceful assembly, and you have laws to give you the protection for peaceful assembly. Instead, they restrict you to only having peaceful assembly in the stadium. You can't do that in the public. It's even worse, because in the past you can assemble peacefully anywhere as long as the numbers does not exceed 5. No, you can't even do that. So in that sense, it is worse. And in many respects, if you look at corruption, for instance, he says that, we are very committed to wiping out corruption. But no one is impressed. Transparency International ranks Malaysia's Corruption Perception Index, and it has actually dropped every year. We are now at number 60. When we used to be at number 37 in 2003. So again and again, the Prime Minister has shown himself to be long on rhetoric, but completely short on action. Which is why I mentioned that he's only a performer. I mean, he talks the talk, but unfortunately he doesn't walk the talk. Thank you.
Sorry. CM, there is an article in the Star today. It mentioned that Malaysians residing overseas will be allowed to vote, postal votes itself. So have the opposition or the government did any survey on potential impact of the coming elections if people like us who have been residing overseas for more than 20 years or even 10 years will be allowed to vote?
Actually, we are also concerned whether this is a ruse to disenfranchise voters. Because those who are allowed to vote overseas, number one, you can, you're supposed to be able to vote overseas. Number two, if you are registered to vote overseas, you happen to be back in Malaysia, you cannot vote in Malaysia. So that goes back to the principal question. What if they suddenly take back the right of overseas Malaysians to vote? You cannot even return to vote. Just like the Indelible Ink. At the last minute, they pull back. So we are very, very concerned about whether this is would be fully implemented, because the Elections Commission, as I mentioned just now, is a tool of the National Front, of Barisan Nasional. They have, even their top members of the Election Commission are unknown members. So in that respect, we urge you if you cannot come back, maybe register. If you're sure you won't be back, then well, register. Hopefully, your vote will count. If you can, try to come home. We need you. Malaysia needs you. Thank you.
One final question in the corner there, the lady with her arm raised.
Thank you. Just been, sir. As you mentioned, a lot of overseas Malaysians are abroad pursuing better economic opportunities. And I would say a lot of them would be very interested to know of perhaps a few key highlights of what, assuming Pakatan were to win, what would be the economic policies pursued, specifically the areas where there is a clear difference to BN, specifically which industries that Pakatan feels is currently not being pursued and that could be opportunity to grow. Thank you.
I think probably I'd just like to touch on a few factors because you want me to go through my Bukujinga, my Orange Book policy presentation. It will probably take the whole day. So I'll just, number one, I think what we'll do is that we'll end corruption. I think by ending this corruption and leakages, we'll be able to, I think, save a substantial amount of money. Number two, I think we need to stress on human talent, on making efforts to build human talent, on bringing back, I think, meritocracy in performance. Of course, not meaning that those who do not excel will not be given opportunity, but at least stressing on excellence and building human talents, because we believe strongly that despite our abundant natural resources, human talents can ensure Malaysia's sustainable and continued prosperity. And thirdly, I think it is very important that we do decentralization, because everything is centralized. For instance, in Penang, I only have control over land and local government. I have no control over public transport. I can't even order a taxi to use taxi meters. Everything is centralized. And the days where the government knows best is over. How can someone who sits in the air-conditioned room in Putrajaya or in Kuala Lumpur decides the fate of somebody as far away as in Sabah or in Perlis or in Penang? There must be decentralization and a fairer share of government revenues. In Penang, we get only 3% of what we pay to the federal government. This must change. And of course, that includes a fairer share of all royalties, especially for Sabah and Sarawak, Kelantan, Terengganu, so that at least they can pull back these resources to developing their own state. I think these are vital areas I think we need to look at. Basically, again, going back to the people. I think it's time that the people decides. The people decides how best the resources are to be used and used on what projects. Thank you.
Chief Minister, thank you so much for your comments today. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for some fantastic questions. Before we let you go and we give you one more round of applause, can you promise to come back in a year's time? Thank you very much. He said, provided he's not in jail. So we will see him here. Thank you again, everybody. Have a wonderful afternoon.